turn it over to Dean Tomaselli.
Thank you, Mariana. And thank you, everybody, for joining us today. Today's a special day at the college. It's Match Day. And Match Day is when our senior medical students, and in fact, all senior medical students around the country, find out where they're going to do their residencies, the next phase of their training. This is the second Match Day in a row during the pandemic, so we've had to modify the celebration of this momentous occasion, but we are celebrating their accomplishment today. In terms of the pandemic, the numbers continue to slowly improve. The positivity rate in our emergency departments is under 10%, and there are fewer than 400 COVID patients in our hospitals. Fortunately, the death rate remains low. People are getting vaccinated. And in our In Conversation series earlier in the pandemic, we discussed the manifestations of COVID in children. And I think it's time for an update. And today, we're fortunate to have Dr. Mark Foca with us, who's an associate professor of pediatrics and a pediatric infectious disease specialist with broad expertise in the diagnosis and management of children who have infectious diseases. Dr. Foca, thank you very much for joining us today.
Why did they do that, Chris, if you think they know how at this point?
Dr. Foca, are you on the line?
Dr. Foca, you'll need to unmute yourself.
Yes, I'm on the line now. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us.
thank you for the introduction and for allowing me to give a brief update on the state of the pandemic in pediatric patients. Before I go into that, I do want to go over a couple of points that I think are extremely important for the pandemic in general. This has been, you know, an extraordinary year. Nothing comes close to it, as far as I can tell, in my lifetime, and I'm almost 60 years old. And it really goes to the fact that this is an entirely new disease. No one has immunity, or no one had immunity at the start. And so we've been able to see the full spectrum of complications that have occurred with COVID-19 over the course of the year, even though in the future, some of those complications may be extremely, extremely rare. And it's allowed the medical and research community really the ability to look at pathogenesis in a way that I don't think we've really seen in a very long time, probably not since the discoveries and institution of therapies for the pandemic of influenza in 1918. So as far as children go, I've been taking care of children with infectious diseases for over 20 years. And, you know, the manifestations of COVID in pediatric patients do and don't fit into past epidemics and even routine annual infections with coronavirus. So there are four coronaviruses that we see routinely in pediatric patients, usually in the winter, and they do cause respiratory disease, but they also cause a significant amount of gastrointestinal disease as well. Generally speaking, those diseases are most manifest in the winter. So in December, January, February timeframe, and that's the seasonality that we're used to. There is no seasonality, as far as we can tell yet, for COVID-19, although that may change with time. And if the last surge here in New York and the tri-state area is any indication, it may be that it also will have a winter seasonal pattern. Now, if you look at other epidemic strains like SARS-CoV-1 and Middle East respiratory syndrome virus, both epidemic coronaviruses, you can see a general pattern too that is somewhat consistent in the past. Children were far less affected in those epidemics. There were 8,000 cases of SARS-CoV-1, and the vast majority of those patients were adults. There were very few children who were infected. And for the most part, they had a febrile illness, but there was very little hospitalization and no mortality, as far as I remember. MERS-CoV is a little bit different in that it's sort of a smoldering epidemic, regional epidemic. And so there are persistent cases over time in the Middle East. But again, children are not as affected, and the vast majority of them are asymptomatic. There are mortality rates in children, but they're much lower than they are in adults. And as far as the outbreak goes in adults, looking at those epidemic strains, we did have a sense of the pattern of morbidity and mortality that might accrue with adult patients. The vast majority of adult patients who died in the hospital died from adult respiratory distress syndrome or acute respiratory distress syndrome, what we're seeing now in the adult population. And it was mostly seen in adults over the age of 65. So that pattern of morbidity and mortality for both pediatric patients and adult patients, generally speaking, is similar to what we've seen in the past. The issue has really been the numbers, the overwhelming numbers of patients that were seen, especially in the spring. We were much better prepared to deal with the surge that occurred in the winter, and we'll go over that a little bit in more detail. But the next thing I want to sort of highlight too is that the enormous amount of scientific progress that has been made in a year, really the medical and research community stepped up in a very big way, and the amount of pathogenesis information, therapeutic information, and vaccinology that has been put forward in the last 12 months is really extraordinary. There's really nothing like it. I mean, we are still 40 years into the AIDS pandemic looking for a vaccine to prevent HIV infection, and we do not have that yet. And in less than a year, we have three vaccines that can prevent SARS-CoV-2. So that's really quite extraordinary. In terms of the research that's been done here at the hospital, you know, the adult infectious disease unit and the hospital in general has been at the forefront of therapeutics. We were heavily involved in the remdesivir trials that were first done in the spring and early summer. We were involved in steroid research, and we've been at the forefront of convalescent plasma as a therapeutic for treating patients in the hospital. And as a result, that spilled over into pediatrics. Dr. Harold, who's the head of our pediatric infectious disease group, initiated the Tri-State Pediatric Collaborative, which is a collaboration between hospitals in Connecticut, New York, and New Jersey, which has looked at predictors of severity of illness in pediatric patients and some of the immunologic aspects of this disease in pediatric and adult patients and how they differ. So, you know, we have been really quite involved in research that's been going on up to this point. As far as vaccines, we've actually been asked to participate in pediatric vaccine trials through the adult vaccinology unit. And I haven't seen those protocols yet, but we should be deciding soon how we're going to proceed with those studies. And I do think that, you know, vaccines are going to be available for pediatric patients, for all pediatric patients in the relatively near future. And we can discuss that a little bit more. In terms of variants, variants are here to stay. The process of viral evolution is going to include variants that either make it more or less transmissible. The ones that are more transmissible are going to become more involved in the community, and the ones that are less transmissible are essentially going to die out. The three variants that are of interest at this point are all more transmissible than the original SARS-CoV-2, but the debates about whether they are lead to greater morbidity and mortality are ongoing. The only research data that I've seen is on the variant from that was first identified in England. And with that variant, we know it's probably 50 to 60% more transmissible than the original isolates. And it may have a greater mortality. But the studies that have been done on that are relatively small. The South African, the isolate that was first seen in South Africa is again more transmissible, but it does not appear to be to lead to any more morbidity and mortality, although vaccines may be less effective against this particular isolate, whereas the isolate B117, which is the isolate that was found in England, is probably just as sensitive to vaccines as the original isolate. And then there's an isolate that was first identified in Brazil, which to some people is more concerning than most, because it has been documented to cause illness in patients who've already had SARS-CoV-2 with a previous isolate. Whether it's more transmissible and less susceptible to the vaccine, it remains, I think, an open question, but it is one that people are looking at quite closely. And there are very few cases of that particular variant in the United States at the moment. The variant that has spread most successfully so far is the B117 variant that was first isolated in the United Kingdom. So that's a general idea of where the epidemic has been and where it's going. I do have to acknowledge that it's been a tough year for everyone. The medical community has really stepped up to do some quite extraordinary work. I hope that in the near future, we'll be able to get back to some semblance of normalcy, at least in terms of contact with family and friends. So thank you.
Terrific, Dr. Foca. That was a great summary. Perhaps a couple of questions.
Sure.
Dr. Harold actually spoke the last time about the longer-term consequences of COVID infection. And obviously in adults, we have long haulers with different sets of symptom complexes. And in kids, we have MIS-C, this mysterious inflammatory syndrome. Is there any update from your perspective on MIS-C? How frequent is it? What are the consequences for kids? Is it like Kawasaki disease in the sense that there are long-term complications that are related to the vasculature that are associated with this?
So that's a great question because the answers remain open. So what I can say is that as of this morning on the CDC website, there are a total of 2,600 or so documented cases of MIS-C in the United States with 33 deaths. When you consider the number of pediatric patients that are have been infected with SARS-CoV-2 over this time frame and age that's susceptible to MIS-C, that total is about 3.5 million. So the number of cases of MISC compared to the number of cases of acute SARS-CoV-2 is relatively small. And if you compare that also to the deaths that have occurred in pediatric patients, and actually even young adults, the percentage of deaths in the United States from SARS-CoV-2 is less than 1% of the total in patients 29 and younger. So it's a very, very small number of deaths in this age group, which is thankful.
Yes.
So MISC itself is an inflammatory syndrome, a hyperinflammatory syndrome. It does have features of Kawasaki's disease in some patients, and features of an entity called toxic shock in other patients. And we do not yet know the long-term effects of having had MISC. I can tell you that I'm involved in a clinic that follows patients after their diagnosis of MISC here at CHAM. And we've seen everyone at least out to 1 month after their diagnosis, and the 6 month visits are ongoing. And at a month, so far, everyone's laboratory values have normalized and their echocardiograms have pretty much all normalized. So it's not yet clear what the long-term effects will be, but the vast majority of patients, at least in the acute phase, seem to recover and do relatively well. Now, a percentage of these patients actually do have long-haul COVID-type symptoms. They are more tired than usual. They might not be as active, the parents feel. And some of them do complain of musculoskeletal symptoms. So there are pediatric patients that do seem to have long-haul symptoms. And we are just really getting involved in that area. There's a grant that's coming out that we are submitting with our adult colleagues to look at long-haul COVID in both adult and pediatric patients.
Yeah, certainly more to learn about that as the disease evolves and as the pandemic subsides, hopefully. Another question about managing pediatric patients with COVID-19. What are the therapeutic options? Are they different than in adults? Are steroids as effective? Monoclonal antibodies? Are there other things? And there are recent reports of SSRIs potentially being effective in the acute management of these patients. What is there any information in the pediatric population?
So, yes. I mean, we do use, in select patients, we use similar therapies to adults. The vast majority of pediatric patients who are admitted to the hospital are found to have SARS-CoV-2 incidentally. You know, they're being admitted for other reasons, and we're screening all pediatric patients on admission. And so some of them are positive, even though that's not why they're being admitted. But for those patients who are symptomatic with respiratory symptoms and require oxygen, they too are getting remdesivir and steroids. We do not routinely use immunomodulators such as tocilizumab the way they are used in adult patients that are admitted to the ICU, but we do use the basic antiviral remdesivir and steroids. We haven't yet looked at using SSRIs in pediatric patients.
So as parents and as grandparents, one of the questions that's arisen is the issue of the timeline, and you did address this, for vaccinating children and young adults, and the conditions under which returning more fully to classroom and classroom learning can be done. So could you address those questions?
Sure. So in terms of vaccination, I looked at New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut to see what their current recommendations are. And so in New York and New Jersey, anyone 16 and older who has certain conditions can be vaccinated. And those include and everything from cancer to kidney disease to sickle cell disease, type 1 or 2 diabetes, children with neurologic conditions or who are immunocompromised. And if you go to the websites for New York and New Jersey, you can see the criteria. In Connecticut, it's a little bit different. It seemed to be going by age alone. And right now they're vaccinating everyone 45 and up. And it looks as if children 16 and older will be eligible for vaccination as of April 5th. And I believe that would be all children, not just children with pre-existing conditions that might make them more likely to have complications from COVID-19. Now, when will the general pediatric population 16 and up be eligible for vaccination? I would assume that's probably going to be sometime in the late spring and summer. I'm sure that most colleges are going to require adolescents to be vaccinated before they go to college. And so that age group, I'm sure, will be vaccinated relatively soon. In terms of vaccinating children under 16, that will take a little bit longer. The studies, each vaccine has already, each company that's produced an EUA-approved vaccine has already stated that they're going to study these vaccines in children and for both safety and efficacy. And so the way it usually works is that we do a stepped approach. And so the first group that'll be tested are probably 12 to 17 or 12 to 16 year olds for each vaccine. And then they'll move down to 6 to 11 and so on. And I know that the Johnson & Johnson group has stated that they're going to go down to 6 months. Now, the data on the 12 to 16 year old patients will probably come out in the late summer, early fall, but I don't expect any data on younger children until much later in the year or the beginning of 2022. Now, in terms of going back to school, I think that the data is fairly clear that the appropriate measures are put in place, for remediation, including distancing, which the CDC today, I believe, is going to reduce the distance that children can be from each other in school from 6 to 3 feet. If masking, distancing, and ventilation are put into place, if the rate of SARS-CoV-2 in the region is low, the chances of transmission in school are fairly low. And in fact, most transmissions appear to be occurring not from student to student, but from staff to staff. And that's likely because people, as you get older, you're more mobile and you're going more places. So it seems to be from all the research that's been done that younger school-age children, it's relatively safe for them to go back to school. And when I say younger, I mean probably under middle school age, grade school and younger. As children get older, the likelihood that they're going to be transmitting more like an adult increases. And so there have been larger outbreaks in high schools and certainly in colleges.
Terrific. Well, let me just thank you for a terrific summary and update on COVID-19, and particularly as it relates to younger people. We all hope that we're reaching kind of the end of the surges and phase of this phase of the pandemic. I think we all recognize that we're not quite there yet, and that we have to continue to do the things that involve distancing, masking, and washing our hands, et cetera. And that might be, some of these things might be carried well into the future. But let me again thank you for updating, and let me thank everybody who joined the call today, and have a terrific weekend.
Thank you very much. Thank you for allowing me to speak.
Sure. Pleasure. Take care.
Bye-bye.